Aber ich sage, das ist der Nussmann. Winter of Champagne, what's now? Anyways, I can see you. It's annoying. I have to go there. Yeah. We're gonna. I'll fix it. And the new Nubus Medish will fix all these things. Now it's temporary. Anyways, this man, we're planning to learn the fourth chapter of the eight chapters. We're already, I think, this is the fourth man that we're learning this book, so it makes sense. I think, according to my calculation. So, and it's in some senses the most central chapter for the main subject of Shmoneh Prakim. Basically all of it, all of the things that you really need to know and practically say in this chapter. So this is our project. You could read it and see what it talks about. You should. Also, I'll tell you what it talks about. And I'll tell you a kind of framework for studying it. And also, we'll start studying it. Good plan. Okay. First, I'm going to tell you a joke about Parshas Noach. So there was a Yid. Reb. The Lechevich, Reb Matcha Lechevich, was a Talmud of Shlomo Kalina. He was one of the central leaders in of the Chassidim in some area and some time. And then what happened was that he died, as people do sometimes. They die. And he had some Chassidim, Talmidim, that were discussing or fighting over who should be the next Rebbe. So there was a Yid there, the Mechel, I think. I forgot who. And they told him that he is the oldest Talmud, the first. He's like the Bereishis, he has to become the Rebbe, because Bereishis is the first. So he said that he's noticed in Shul that most of the Chamushim are ripped. When you open the Chamush, it actually starts in Parshas Noach. So he thinks that Noach should be the Rebbe, and there was a guy Noach over there. And he Taka became the Rebbe.
Is this a joke or a true story?
It's a true story that I just read in the Matl Slanim. It was either Matl Chaim Slanim. He has a book of stories and he writes this story. True story. Very deep story. Anyways. Okay, that's just a story. And you can think about what's the pshat. Just because I have to say the stories.
I'm sure you'll find some.
I have a whole
find some more pesachim for this story later in this year.
I don't know if in this year. I have a whole pshat of Malach already to explain Parshas Noach based on this mass. But I also have a different malach. My chavrisa this morning told me a whole different malach to explain the Mabul based on this shir, so we'll see. I started telling you before. But anyways, so this chapter is the fourth chapter. Its title is Berfuas Cholei HaNefesh, the healing of the sicknesses of the soul. And this title is just only really makes sense in the context of the titles of all the chapters of the book, which are organized in something that goes like this, right? The first chapter is the parts of the soul. Second chapter talks about the. It says Miria keches hanefesh v'dias achelik asher boi eloyim motzi amalis v'pchisias. Or in other words, the first chapter is about the soul and its parts or its powers, because he doesn't really believe in the word parts. The second chapter is about which of these parts or have something that can be described as Chesroines or Meri, which is, how do you say it in English? Disobedience or defects. In other words, the problems of the soul. But it's more of a definitional chapter. It basically describes which parts of the soul have which kinds of perfections and imperfections, right? That's Malas Chesroines. So that's the logic that he worked with. And then the third chapter is titled On the Sicknesses of the Soul, which really doesn't add a lot to the previous two chapters. It all sort of only gives you a name. It does add something. We discussed at length what it adds. But it just gives a name to these imperfections of the soul and calls them sicknesses, and therefore they need to be healed. And it defines a little bit of, in general, in an abstract sense, what kind of sicknesses there are, and therefore what kind of healings they would need. And therefore, by this logic, the fourth chapter is the actual healing of the soul. That, and just to be clear, these four chapters are the whole system. Okay? The fifth chapter is sort of the goal of this system. It's titled the Unusing All Parts of the Soul for One End. That's sort of the capstone of the whole system, and that's the end. The sixth and seventh and eighth chapters are in some sense side notes. Of course, they're important things for the system, but his whole system really can be, or the system of ethics that he presents here, in order to interpret the Psech HaZovos according to it and all of that, is only can be reduced to sort of these two things, right? There is a soul, it is such and such, and therefore its perfection is such and such. And if you want to add a third thing, which would be important, would be the practice of how to perfect it. In other words, the technique of healing.
So it's more necessary for Psech HaZovos specifically.
Also. All of this is Psech HaZovos.
I know what I'm saying is that...
Unlike...
It's not necessarily integral to the system of the soul, it's just integral to the practical...
Yeah, it's and this is the most important, because as we discussed in the preface once, the end of studying ethics is to be good, not to know what the good is. The
kind of knowledge that we're learning is...
Yeah. But just to be clear, because of that, the fourth chapter is central in that sense, because that's where he defines, finally, what does it mean, or what is the real definition of the good...
Practice of ethics, right.
The practice, the good parts of the soul. In other words, what the good activities are, which the soul, which does those good things, or tends to do those good things, is a good soul. And also discusses the technique of healing, which is extremely important. That's all in this fourth chapter. I think it's the longest or one of the longer chapters in this book. And that's why I said it's enough for... If we finish by Pesach, we should be happy. So that's the general structure. Now, what does it talk about or what does it say? We'll do like this. I wrote headers so I could cheat from them. But what it talks about and what it says... is divided like this, and I'm going to give you my overview of how I do every time, and therefore we could sort of have a kind of plan for like spend a month on this and a month on that, and you'll realize that it's a lot more months than I said. Anyways, every part in every chapter in Shemoneh Perakim is set up, well, not explicitly, we discussed this, I think the Rambam sort of hides this in this book, or doesn't make it as explicit as he could have, but it's set up in this way. There is philosophical concepts, which he quotes... mostly word for word from Al-Farabi, and we'll show you that. I don't know if I already did some for some parts. Al-Farabi's book, also called Chapters or Aphorisms, which is in Arabic the same word for chapter at least, whether it means the same thing, I don't know, but the word Fasul is the same word that Rambam uses for his chapters, and Al-Farabi in our translation is called Aphorisms, but they're the same Arabic word. And he literally translates all the technical philosophical content is word for word from that book. With the important difference that Rambam shortens it extremely and gives you very, very little of the actual philosophical explanation of the content. Al-Farabi is already an epitome, it's already shortened from Plato and Aristotle, as he says, the ancients, called the ancients in his language. It's already very shortened, so it doesn't have all of the dialectic, doesn't have any proof, any explanation, it's just the conclusions. And Rambam already shortens that. So we're three steps removed from actually understanding what's going on, but that's just so you should know what it's how it's set up. But that's what he does in this chapter too. The second thing that he does in every chapter is this important thing for him, which is the interpretation part, right? Or the Torah part, right? So we could divide each chapter into a philosophy part and a Torah part. Second part is the Torah part, which is obviously not quoted from Al-Farabi because Al-Farabi didn't quote the Torah in that book, didn't quote the Quran either. It's not a religious book at all, it's purely philosophical or, more precisely, political philosophy book. But Rambam spends most of his time, or probably we could say most of his time in this book, after just establishing the facts or the philosophical concepts, not arguments, concepts, very important, of this subject, he goes on to explain how this works in the context of both the Torah, in the sense of Torah Shebiksav, which the Rambam sees as very important. He's not as much a rabbinical Jew as we tend to be. And of the Chachamim, the rabbis, the Torah Shebaalpeh. And when he does that, that's the place where most people start and the place where we have to push off to like the second half of our project, because we don't my big claim is that most people don't understand the concepts themselves, and therefore this is a very great problem in Jewish studies, meaning Jews that study, besides from being meaning Jewish studies, where everyone starts or from the discussion, okay, so the Rambam took this ethical system and superimposed it on the Torah or combined it somehow, braided it together with the Torah, did some kind of, you know, documentary hypothesis weaving, putting a little apusik and shtiklarista and apusik and shtiklarista, and somehow they're supposed to become into one story, and then people talk about the contradictions and other contradictions and was he right and does everyone agree and all of that. Problem with that is, by the way, for ethics, very few people really understand how to do that. That's a side note, right? I think pretty sure that...
To do what?
How to... I said this many times. How to even notice the fact that the ethics that Rambam, for example, has, and every other yid that ever had an ethical system, which is some sense of a philosophical system, whether it's Aristotle or Plato or any other philosophical source, and then does the same radical move of the Meir HaNevi'im or of Sadia or of anyone known as a radical philosopher to put it into the Torah, right? Like, for example, besides, the only other side is the, like, real Litvaks, who are just command theories people. Just, we have to,
They don't have ethics.
Or if they have ethics, it's a divine command ethics, but it's not an ethics at all, it's just follow the law. But actually, even those Litvaks don't really believe in that ethics because, for example, for most of them, when they talk about something called Avodas Hashem or Avodas Hamidus, they're straight back into Aristotle. The entire concept of Steiging is an Aristotelian concept. It doesn't say in the whole Torah that you should Steig. It does say in Aristotle. I mean, not in those words, but it's a translation or a mistranslation of something. Right? So anyone that speaks of Steiging just means human progress, right? Like progress as a person. And that's a fully Aristotelian concept. I'm not saying it's not a Torah concept, but people have a very hard time even noticing that.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to dogma, it's easy to notice. So, is the soul like this or like that? Is God like this or like that? People right away notice, wait, I think the Pusik said differently. For ethics, actually, very much less people notice it. And either, why is that? Good question.
Ethics also could share a lot of framework and doesn't necessarily make as accurate, like as precise claims, right?
So it's either because it's true that the Aristotelian ethics are much closer to what you would get naively reading the Torah and Chazal, for example. That's very questionable because, of course, nowadays most people aren't after Aristotelians or they're confused Kantians. And that's, we have a whole different theory. And secondly, it could be that the Rambam was just more successful at his job in these areas than other areas. Right? These are not the same exact theory. Right? Because it's possible that just that...
I would think also people just assume... People, when they discuss the soul, like ethics, I mean, not Fuki, the soul, they're more familiar with it, so they just think it's, like, obvious. They'll say it, like, maybe someone makes an argument for this, and they'll say it as, like, an obvious claim.
Right, the question is that...
Whereas, like, on the soul, they don't even begin to understand, like, the arguments.
Because they a little bit understand the subject.
They actually understand the subject somewhat, which is themselves.
Or at least they practice it in some way.
So they can just say it and actually know somewhat what they mean. And therefore, it's just like so obvious, they just take it for granted almost. So it's very easy to put into anything.
Okay. All of these things are possible. Anyways, I'm not supposed to be talking about this now. This is just for me to tell you that everyone starts there, although it's harder for ethics, but there's still a lot, you know, we could talk. The Rambam himself makes explicit in chapter 6, right? One disagreement between the philosophers and the Torah, and very much. So that's the only thing that he actually makes clear, that there's a disagreement and he tries to reconcile them. But that's the part which is should be put off. And we should try to first understand the actual concept. And for that, we're going to have to read the Rambam and read all the resources and think. Makes sense, right?
Yes.
Alright, so now, if we talk about what are the actual concepts that are here, and this is hard because most people also not don't even know how to study concepts in a clear way, right? We know, for example, For example, we know how to like take one's basic point and then read the whole Masechta Sovos in light of it. That's what like the good commentaries do. The amazing thing that you discover when you read actual philosophy, or if you actually start thinking, but usually if you think yourself, you also get stuck in loops, you need other people, is that the concepts themselves are a lot richer, or a lot more multifaceted, have a lot more detail to them than it seems from even the Rambam, right? The Rambam's presentation is very misleading, because Rambam's like, there's this concept, it's two lines, and then he spends 60 lines on explaining all the psukim that it says in. And there's a lot of detail in that, and we can understand the detail in that, because there's a lot of psukim, a lot of contradictory chazal that you have to reconcile and make into at least a coherent picture. But the actual thought lies in doing that exact thing, and maybe even more at length, for the concept. And people read Aristotle or read actual philosophy and sometimes say, well, this is repetitive. It's not repetitive. It's only repetitive if you never think about things about themselves. So,
and think of the concept is too small to continue to be.
It seems to be too small, exactly. It seems to be too small because mostly because it's not open in the sense of questions. If we don't have know the questions, then we can't. There's no sugya. There's nothing to discuss. Yeah, I think so. So that's something that has to be opened a lot and try to find ways to open it. So what we, some of the ways that I've written down and thought of how to open here is like this. So. The beginning of the chapter. And, oh, hello. We're just starting.
Oh, wow.
So the beginning of this chapter talks about give this concept. Maybe we should do like this. Maybe we should just read these lines and then because I have to start reading a little, and then we should do some explanation forensics. Of some forensics. We'll start and also more overview of what that leads to and what we need to start to understand. Okay, the first thing is like this, okay? This chapter starts like this, and you're right away going to think that it's repetitive if you got up there in the previous three chapters, and I have to explain to you why it's not repetitive. Or at least it's trying to add something. And it says like this. The good activities, the good activities, okay, now you should read this and say, if you start here, you should read this and say, who mentioned... No, first you should realize, did we mention that? It seems like he's talking about the good activities. So we must have already spoke about the good activities, and I'm waiting for someone to tell me finally what these good activities are. So there's a continuation here, right? You should follow the structure of the argument or of the exposition and see that there must be somewhere where he mentioned that. And he did. He mentioned it. I'll tell you where. I could tell you where, and I wrote down here more. It is in chapter 3, right? Beginning of chapter 3 said, the Bris HaNefesh, the health of the soul, is that her tchunas, which are something like predispositions, are those that will cause her to do the good activities. He had three words for the good activities, as I had here, and we had a whole class to explain what those three words are doing. But it basically says, it says pilis anois, which are the same thing as, in general, they're the same thing as pilis atoivis. Or all those three add up to pilis atoivis. Okay, so that's where we had it. And which means, and I'm showing it to you, which means that you should have read the previous chapter and said, and realized, and I think that if you read it with me, I already told you the secret, so you might be not able to read this correctly. But you'll see that he said something like this. There are sicknesses of the soul and health of the soul. Sickness of the soul is that the soul's parts does not cause it to do good things. That's sort of the definition. Now, and you should have noticed right away, this is a very not useful definition. Because the next question should be,
what are those things?
What are the good things? And thank you very much. It took him some time, 2 pages in my book, and then he answered the question. Right? So we know that there's a difference between these two things. We already know that from the last two shirim, I think, that I gave before Yom Tov were about defining the difference between what chuna is, or predisposition, what a midah is, which is a habit or a correct way of acting towards something or having it in you.
We didn't discuss. We discussed the day, midah, and derech.
Yeah, and derech is tchuna, Middah is the middah, and derech is the habit or the.
And there was feeling.
Yeah, feeling. Okay, so there's four things. As I said, there's really four things. But anyways, we discussed all of that. But now we know exactly what. Now we have to discuss all of these things exactly, right? Just to be clear, the four things that we discussed are, and I will do it in the order. The first thing that a person has is, let's call a predisposition, which means a person who tends to get angry easily or tends to love something, right? What people mean when they say, I'm that kind of person most of the time. Just a predisposition, right? It's not really the kind of person you are. Because what kind of person you are is something more complicated in this system, in our picture, right? That's one thing, okay? Second thing is you actually feeling that feeling. Remember? In other words, I'm the kind of guy that a slight thing triggers me and I get angry. That's a predisposition. Maybe it's a makeup of my body, literally. That's what Aristotle believed. This is not a chiddush of some modern philosopher, if a psychologist. It was believed in ancient times already that predispositions have to do with bodily things, configurations of your blood and your all kind of things like that. Yeah, your black bile and the yellow one and whatever the theory is.
Is that everything or just anger?
No, everything. All middos, all loves and hates, which in some sense, all the things that you, all emotions and maybe also activities and not such very much. Then we have the actual feeling, right? What we call the feeling or passion. And known as feeling is a modern word. Because feeling is a very tricky word. When I say feeling,
in the potential feeling, the actual feeling, and potential versus the actual feeling.
Yes,
right? Physical in the sense that I need a doctor to help me.
No, that's why. Wait, that's why I said the word feeling we discussed is a very not good word, because feeling is also could mean sensation, which has nothing to do with what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. So what we say, the word emotion is slightly better, or what the people used to say is passion. And there's a whole history of this, why people changed from passion to emotion to feeling, and has to do with the reinterpretation or the misinterpretation of passions as sensations, which people like Thomas Hobbes and John Locke all did. They all misinterpreted passions even as sensations, because they're trying to do this reductionist thing and saying love is not anything but feeling a tingling in your or somewhere when you meet someone. But it's not that. That's a condition of it, but it's not that. But anyway, so that's what we have these. Do I have to exactly the capacity? Or if it's not only the capacity, people have different kinds of capacities. That's why there's something to talk about, right? Some people, in other words, what you're born with, and Rambam will talk about this in chapter 7, what you're born with, or chapter 8, which was it? What you're born with. Then there is the actual feeling. You're still not feeling anything. Then there's the actual feeling. I feel a hate, I feel a love, I feel anger. What we call emotions. Some people feel them very strongly. Some people feel them.
Feeling taking place.
Sometimes, very exactly. The feeling taking place. That is also not. Both of these things have, and as Aristotle says in chapter, I think, book 2, chapter 5 and 4, in the beginning of that book, these both things have no moral sense, moral value. We don't blame or praise someone for feeling feelings. Not a mitzvah or an avaira, like the Rambam would say in Perek Beis, right? There's no, those things belong, in the Rambam sense, they don't even belong to the part of the soul where he puts the, this is maybe more complicated.
Even the capacity is morally agnostic?
Yeah, capacity for sure. We'll get to the different kind of capacity that you're thinking about, wait. Yeah, the first potential, so to speak, is morally, is just a fact. It doesn't, it's not, just to be clear, it's not virtuously agnostic, in the sense of, because virtue changed, is not the same, right, as moral entirely. Yeah. But in any case,
and it can be moved closer to the.
Wait, we're going to get to changing it. Now I'm talking about only in the sense of predisposition. Okay, both of these things are not what we're looking for. Okay, then there is a third thing, which is the most important thing, which is like in the pure Aristotelian potential actuality language, would be something like the second.
Carried out?
The second, not the carrying out. Carrying out is actual actuality. Okay. There's always a level.
Or the potential actual?
Yeah, the second potential or first actual in Aristotle's language. But this is only helping people that speak that code. But in other words, it's the actually. There's really two different things, okay? That's why we divide this into the four things. Okay, the first two we had clear. And this third thing is, let's say something, let's start with this, so the fourth thing, and then you'll get back to the third thing, okay? The fourth thing is the actually behaving relative to these sensations, and therefore also to these capacities, in the correct way. So in other words, feeling love, just if love arises in some by some arousal or some trigger, that's not a moral thing. That's not what we talk about. That's not a virtue or a vice. But feeling love in the correct way or in the non-correct way is a virtue or a vice. And that is something which you can control. And here I'm going to get to the third thing, which is how do you control it? It's not determined by the capacity or by the having the feeling. Is determined by something we call education, moral education, or virtue education, which is teaching the capacity or the feeling to be first felt actuality. In the correct to be felt in the correct way or the correct time or the correct place and the correct amount, and so on.
Training the minda.
Yeah, what we call
abhijasamadhi. So is the third controlling the second?
No. Nothing here is. There's. I'm not. What this whole model that I'm giving you here. I mean, this is the thing I need a blackboard for. This whole model that I'm giving you here is not. Is nothing to do with the picture that you get from Plato, like the controlling part and the controlled part. We're not talking about this now.
We said no projector in there.
Not a projector. I need a blackboard to write this list on. That's what I need. I'm gonna get one, Mitzvah, because it would help me here. You get what I'm saying? This is very important. And I gave a whole class about this or more than, but you have to remember, there is a different model. This model doesn't have what the other model has. Okay? And so we can keep track of this. It's very important to remember, and it has to be basic, because otherwise we're not able to continue. There is a different model, which is the pneumatic model of Midas, right? The energy model, I call it. Okay? That model says, and you might find some sense of it in Plato, and for sure in Freud, and in other, in Tanya maybe, in other places. That model says that there are raw feelings, emotions that arise in a person, by nature, by nurture, it doesn't matter. Those are, and that's what a midah is. And the job, the person who has good midah, so to speak, is the one who controls those. This is the virtue of temperance in ancient language. The person who controls those correctly, right? So the mind, the rational part, controlling these midahs. That is model... number one, model number two, really. That is not Aristotle's model.
So the Aristotle's model is that what? The fourth thing?
That's not Aristotle's model. Aristotle's model is, where to reconcile this with his model would be.
Controlling the feelings. You mean controlling what the result of the feelings is?
No, controlling the having of them.
Actual feelings itself.
Yes. Both, of course, but also.
Doesn't it just.
Well, like you get very good. That's a question for the people that have that model, how it works.
Right.
I think that the people that have that model don't have a good account of how it works. That's why it's a weaker model. Uh-huh. That's the main weakness of it. It's a very good theoretical, it's a very simple theoretical model, a lot simpler than my Aristotle's theoretical model. But what it's missing is what does we even mean when we say repressing amida?
Right.
It's very not clear what that means in that model.
Which is why people assume that it has to be done militantly.
Usually people think of it in a sense of power. Plato also, okay, let's not remember too many things.
Meaning we're trying to...
yes, not usually what happens is that people understand it just as only as self-control, and therefore all of this is boiled down to self-control, and remember that, according to the Aristotle and the Rambam, self-control is the bad way of doing things. Mm-hmm. You should not need self-control. If you need self-control, there's something wrong with you. Right? And if you ask any modern therapist, they'll also tell you. Self-control is not a
model. Sense of, like, pushing...
Doesn't
self-control.
Exactly, in the sense of pushing. The reasonable
saying
part,
no, not here.
Saying no, and another time saying yes, right? You should not love this, and you should love God. So somehow the self-control is pushing and pulling.
Right.
There's no, it's very, there's a very, there's not an account of how this is supposed to work or what it means.
Get it to Aristotle, so what is...
Okay, so back to, this is just to be clear, that's why usually when you ask if this third is pronounced that, you're thinking of a model like
that. I didn't mean that. What I'm really asking is when you actually are acting, you have the act of love, and then after the fourth step.
The act by itself...
How is that one different than the love in the second step?
No, because it's the correct one. That's the real difference. because it's the correct one.
One is the correct one.
In some sense. It could be, by random chance, it might be that someone would be born with his predispositions correct. It doesn't really happen. It might, that's such a miracle, or not a miracle. A miracle in the sense of a very rare occurrence of nature, it might actually happen. Yeah. Like, impossible metaphysically. But it doesn't really happen. People aren't born and aren't educated perfectly. But it's, so just to make it more clear, and that's why we get later people having language of first nature and second nature, and they say that middos are second nature, right? Teva shiny. And all that means is, so to make very clear, what that means is that a middah toiva is something, or a virtue in this world, is something a lot broader than either an urge, or what we call a feeling, a passion, or a control of the urge, or some kind of continually controlling your urges or something like that. And in some sense, a middah toiva is not something that exists at one time. You can't really see it in one piece of time, and almost explicitly, I mean, Aristotle explicitly says that nobody has virtue unless they have virtue for a complete life. That's maybe a very big demand. But that makes sense if you remember our theories about narrative and all of that. Because having a virtue doesn't mean right now. I mean, of course, it has to start somewhere, but it doesn't mean I'm right now doing something. What it means is that I'm the kind of person or who has the correct judgment and the correct... Okay, correct judgment is another thing, but it's the same thing, but you understand that has the correct loves and hates and the correct ways in the same time. And in other words, you can't see it once. You have to see that he has it here and not there, right? You sort of need...
You're not looking
you
to train the derech, you're looking to train the middah.
Well, the middah is the whole story.
It's, should those that come up, this is, it would be carried out in accordance with a certain...
Right, but what we're looking for is really not... I mean, maybe you could say he has it potentially, but what we're looking for in actuality is, in other words, you have to have... If someone says there's a correct amount of love of food and a correct amount of food to eat and a correct amount of loving it, right?
Regardless of circumstances, perfect. Carried out...
The correct amount of eating is not a practical diet thing, right? The correct amount of loving food... Right? Now, how do I know that if you have the correct amount? It's not like this moment I'm not loving it. Okay, maybe that's part of it, but it's really if I'm working through a whole day or a whole week or a whole year and doing it the correct times and not the correct times. So it's a whole story. A middah takes time to have a middah.
New sample size.
What?
New sample size.
Yeah.
To measure it.
Not only to measure it, it consists of something broader. Of course,
you're acting
also
in accordance with a certain principle, uniformly.
Yes, right. So, in other words, there's the action, which I call the fourth part, which is actually acting. That action itself is usually, in Aristotle's world, an action is not an atomic thing, generally. We don't act in the sense of, this is also very useful, and there's modern self-help people that realize this. Actions are not atomic things, not like I'm doing something now. People act within entire frameworks of who I am, and where I am, and what I'm doing, and we'll discuss this in another.
Yeah, we said so.
Changing Tikkun HaMa'asim isn't. That's why the Ram, even Nach Tshuva says Tikkun HaMa'asim means changing your name, changing, moving somewhere, going to a new coil, I don't know, you know, taking a new job,
way.
Exactly, or maybe slowly, or maybe in not in a radical way. But it has people don't, you know, how do you act? Most of the people act as automatic, and that's what Rav Dessler said. No, most of the time you're not exercising your bechira, but he has a picture of bechira that's very weird, because he thinks of bechira, which is the same word for action, as something very atomic, like, am I exercising my free will now? But that's not what training of human is. I'm saying too many things.
Can I? I don't know. I know you don't want to play, but just one nafkamina. It seems that the nafkamina is: do you hold that when you practice self control, does that change it? Maybe that's not it. Like, does that change it?
Plato doesn't, in the Plato or the Republic story, there isn't...
You're explaining, it's not really changing. You're constantly practicing self-control, and then that's what it is.
It's weird because...
Our system might end up being, and I think it is going to...
If you practice self-control...
Is that when you practice self-control, that actually changes. It's not like... Self-practice self-control
right,
is a mechanism...
Right, but just to be very clear, this is like... Well, like I said before, that we have to be able to open up concepts. There's a whole chapter later about self-control versus having good middahs.
Right.
And we have to get to that for like a few months and figure out exactly how to describe it. I would, in a short way, we would say something like, habituation is not exercising necessary self-control. And then the practical way, and since I think that the big value of the system is that it gives you practice, maybe it's wrong theoretically, I don't know. Aristotle even says, who cares about the theory? Let's try to do something that works. He says things like that. In this
the
book.
Person dies having practiced self-control for a while. It's not
wait, but like what I would say, something like, again, since we imagine self-control, and even Plato imagines self-control as something requiring some level of thumos, right? Anger. Plato says you need anger. which is another word for what we you call violence, right? Militancy, or like whatever Milo Bideman is doing all the time.
Like always a clash.
Yeah. Now, and that is one. That is what Plato says, and I think that in order. Now, it could be, you have like a good question, if someone keeps on doing that, will he end up having the middah?
Maybe as a situation, but
maybe he will, and maybe not.
Change.
But I would actually say, so I don't know, that might be sometimes yes and sometimes not, I don't know.
Some people have this daya in excess, right, this daya of internal militancy.
Wait, that's another middah that we have to think about. Okay, very good, that's the middah of temperance. That's what Aristotle would say. That middah, just one middah called temperance. But now, or maybe he would say that, I don't know. I don't know if that's true. That's a theoretical and practical question that should be researched. Do people who practice this overcoming of themselves all the time actually end up liking? Because remember what the definition or the sign at least of having a middah for Aristotle and Rambam is loving it and taking pleasure in doing that. Do people end up okay? But that's not what we're looking for. We're looking for taking pleasure. That's just a Nazi, right? We're looking for.
If that self-discipline will lead to actually enjoying the exercise and the food and the healthy smoothie, right?
Right. That's what we're asking. Does he end up enjoying
enjoy
the doing
they
well?
They can enjoy it as enjoying the smoothie. They can enjoy it as an act of self-discipline.
Why? He keeps on fighting.
Right.
And fighting.
So that enjoying it, I'm not asking about enjoying the self-discipline. If you enjoy that, that's just sadism. Now, I don't know if it's just that. Okay. Maybe sadism is the excess of self-discipline. Like there's a correct measure of everything. But does he end up enjoying the good measure of things that seems to be forcing himself towards? I think often he doesn't. But then there's that
the pop culture version of psychology is that it never works and like it's always gonna explode.
Freud doesn't believe it works, right? Yeah. It's always repressing or transforming or things. Yeah, actually I don't know. I shouldn't make such big claims. Yeah, it's the pop version. Yes. So that's because of this pneumatic model of things, where there's always these bubbles pushing and pushing back the levers or pushing the other ones. But they're just there. They just know they're not even human in some sense at all. Those things. That's the Yetzer Hara, exactly. Okay, maybe there's the Yetzer Hara. Meanwhile, we didn't talk about the Yetzer Hara. We just talked about what exists in the human. If there's the Yetzer Hara, Rambam would say this is the Yetzer Hara, but if there's a separate Yetzer Hara, then a whole different story. Just to answer your question. Right, and now for the practical answer to that, Aristotle would also tell you that it's a waste of energy to exercise self-control for habituation. You don't really need that. You understand why? In other words, this is a question, I wonder if this is true, but what can be said, and what I would tell people practically is that if you understand that it's the habituation that leads you to have the love of the correct thing, you should actually look for times when it's easy, right? This is enough commitment. If you think that you need self-control, then if it's harder, you get more out of this somehow. But what habituation theory says, no, how about just make it easy for yourself, set up your circumstances that be like that, or even if someone else external forces, you remember that their theory of education, of course of education, of reward and punishment of the Rambam and Aristotle, how am I keeping on saying this? Find a better way, is that the reward and punishment will end up habituating people because they start by loving the reward and hating the punishment, and they end by loving the thing itself, right? Because they're not exercising self-control, they're just exercising self-interest, which is different. They're not fighting themselves. They're saying, I don't want the punishment, I want the reward. And then, just by doing it enough, it's the activity of doing it that leads you to love it, not the why. So, and in that sense, what he's giving you is a much easier way of doing things. Like, it's not worth. Like, anytime if you're trying to do a diet or something, anytime you're looking for willpower, you're already lost. Like, you're already working too hard. You should just set up a life where you have a good breakfast and a good lunch and a good supper. And then just automatically, you'll start liking it. Does that mean, then the people ask, well, you never have an assign? I don't even know what that means. Again, you're thinking of some demon that you have to break. No, you could change your habit. Not course of things. You could always go against it for once, but you're going to not like it, right? So you'll have this, like, some kind of inertia to push you back into the thing that you're more used to. Or in the same way, this is also why if someone has a, it's about tshuva in some sense, right? If you have a very long bad habit, there's basically no way to fix it in this sense entirely. That's why about tshuvas are the ones that have to do all the weird things.
But it works the other way too, that if you're saying the habit, right, ends up making you like it, but then the habit of you pushing and pulling and pushing and pulling makes you like that too, how you get out of that?
It makes you like pushing and pulling.
Yeah.
So that's why you should never start pushing and pulling. Not a good idea.
But a person who's...
Maybe sometimes you need... Which person?
Let's say this diet. Let's say you got it, right? His whole life, food is the enemy. The enemy and...
The pushing and pulling is not a very good idea.
No, I agree. I'm saying, but he... There's no... I don't know how you say it. There's no... Because he's doing that out of habit too, right? That's what he knows. Like, how does he get?
Okay, so wait. You want to know how to fix? Okay, these are really technical questions. We're supposed to talk. This, like, how do you change your habit? How could you change? There's always these like feedback loops.
That's part of my question. The other part of the question: doesn't he end up loving that way too? Because that's what he does.
You end up loving to having fights with yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think
right.
so.
Oh, okay.
I think so. I think that's very messed up. But yeah.
I'm saying, but that's.
I think that happens to people. Right. I think that most people. Would be, and there's like explicit if you read like
Tzemach Atlas is the muscle.
Talks about this? I don't remember. I didn't read it actually.
Tzemach Atlas, he just loves just fighting and beating himself.
Yeah, I think that people that.
The second it becomes easy, it's like he hates himself.
Yeah. I think people that. There's many people that would be very upset if they lose their Yetzer Hara. That's whether it's not their goal. Because they say, what am I like in this whole thing? Okay, but that's not. Yeah, this is okay. So back to where we are. We just started to read one line, and we just reminded ourselves of what? We just reminded ourselves of the basic stuff about what's going on with how do you call it? The structure that we're talking about. Okay, so our structure is that there's predispositions, there's sensations or passions. And there's a third thing called active states, sometimes called habits, sometimes called middos, which is the acting correctly relative to these loves and hates and passions, right? And that acting correctly has in itself, in some sense, two parts, or you could even talk about three things if you want, right? There's the potential for it in the sense of, I am the kind of person that always responds in the correct way to these triggers or arouses the triggers by myself in the correct way. And there's the action doing it, okay, which are almost the same. And then there's the way of getting there, which we just started discussing, like this, the answer of habituation, which is how you change. And then, in some sense, you could say you change your predisposition. But that's not, we're going to make the difference between, distinction between like born predispositions and learned predispositions that are not predispositions, they're really something more active than that, right? Something more chosen, more human. And that's what you get blamed and praised for. That's what a good habit is, okay? Or a good middah is. But now, that all we know, all of this we should know already. Almost. I think that all of this, you know, we should know already, or at least it's presumed in everything until now, until this line. Now we have to go to the next thing, which is to say, like this, that we still don't know the main thing, right? You see how long you got to understand one line? Now we still know the main thing. The main thing is that we just said that, okay, very nice. So now we have this whole picture. We know very nice everything. What we don't know is, what are the good things to do? Right? Because all we explained is the structure of the soul and the way in some, not entirely the way, but the structure of the how the way of fixing the soul will work. Okay, all of that we know. But we don't know what are the good activities that we're looking for, the habituations and predispositions and things to do, to aim at, right? I just said the good, that's what we had already had this in the previous chapter, and it's a little backwards, but we already, the Rambam should have started, he writes a little backwards and causes them to be a little more repetitive than he needs to be. But we already started with this, we told you that a healthy soul is the one who has its, has middos that cause it to do good things, but we don't know what the good things are. The correct activities are. So that's where we're starting here. We're starting here with telling us what the correct activities are, and then we'll go back to tell you, okay, now, the correct middos are the ones which lead to the correct activities. So really, we should have started here, in some sense. But then you wouldn't understand that there's something called a middle. You refer to only activities. So that's, now we're going to get an answer for this question. Okay? And it says like this. The good activities are the equal ones. That's Shava is in Hebrew. Shava means equal. Equal in the sense of not too much or not too little. Not equal as a sense of one thing being equal to another. Right? Equal in the sense of, if you want, you could say intermediate, but the actual traditional like language here is equal always. I don't know if you have a better word for it. Something like
balanced, proportionate.
Balanced would be good. Somewhat good. Okay. These are balanced between the, that's the next word should be translated as balanced. Mitzvos, balanced or proportioned between two sides, between two extremes, both of whom are bad. One of these extremes is too much, and one of them is too little. This is the whole definition of good things, good activities. Now you know what good activities are. The activities are the equal ones, or the mean ones, right? And therefore, it goes on the next sentence to tell you, therefore...
The equilibrium here is not necessarily...
We're going to talk about what it means.
Right.
Give me a second. And then it goes on, just want to read one paragraph, or two paragraphs in my thing. And therefore, we go back, v'hamales, the virtues are... The Rambam has these two words, t'chines, nafshes, v'kinyonim. But I think that if you would, let me see. Probably the kinyan is the better word, because remember that t'china is something like predisposition that we discussed. And the second thing is really what we call kinyan in Ibn Timon's language. If I could find a better, an English word for this. States and, no, this person didn't find a good translation. You understand what I mean by the difference between t'china and a kinyan? T'china is what we, the Rambam later would call it only achana, a different technical word. Predisposition, what I said. A kinyan is like predisposition that you bought. That's the difference. The predisposition that you didn't, not what you're born with, but that you bought. Mm-hmm. That you created for yourself, that you created yourself into. That's the more. So it's a kind of disposition, right? It's a disposition that you get credit for. Like the Belzeru used to say that
worked on person.
You'll see the Belzeru of the Baal Belz used to say that his father told him that the middah that a person is born, generally there's not good to praise yourself with your great virtues, but things that you were born with you're allowed to praise yourself with, because there's nothing so great about you, you're just born with that good middah.
Praising God.
So he used to say that he holds that he was born with kindness, and it's nothing, just he was just born that way, and he would say like, you know, I'm a kind person.
It's funny because I think people tend to think the opposite.
The opposite? Right.
Well, because they
might. People have a problem with you saying you're smart, but saying that I taught myself how to think well. Right? You're saying they shouldn't say I taught myself.
Well, that's because people want to praise themselves. They don't want to praise God. So they're looking for things that they get credit for.
No.
It's not because they think it's more like humble or something.
It's not considered showing off to say I taught myself how to think well.
No,
but to say I'm smart.
No, that's for a different reason. You should read some. The reason it's not accepted in our society. It's not nice to say that you're smart. Just like it's not nice to say that you have more money than someone else. It's because we believe too much in egalitarianism. No, because
no, what I'm saying, but people are okay saying I'm not smart. I think better than you.
I understand. No, okay, but this is why. This is because of democratic beliefs.
Oh, okay.
And like it's considered the it's like a social gaffe, like to go around saying I'm smart or I have more money. Anything that shows the inborn, or not even entirely inborn, but some like hierarchy between people, we have a social norm to pretend they don't exist. It's part of a whole. There's a lot of like social research about this, and at least we live in a society that's extremely like this. Mm-hmm. It's not accepted to present yourself as more than someone. Everyone is pretending to be equal all the time, which is in some sense a good thing. But that's why people still like to praise themselves, but. That's a less problem because we all believe in effort. We don't believe in.
That's what I was saying. That's
we're supposed to believe in effort, like we do. The teacher keeps on talking about getting. You know, my daughter came home from school with saying that teacher said that it doesn't matter if you get a test. Main thing is the effort. I told her, I don't know about other kids. It's not for you. You better get 100 on the test. But like, what do you mean? That's not like the teacher should push you to get 100. Then the tati should say, you know, if you never has a stupid kid, okay, you tried your best, but. it seems to me like the wrong confusion I've rolled. But no, what I mean to say is that yeah. I get that. I mean, I don't say it's. I don't know if it's, there's some good and bad in that, but it's not. Not. It's considered weird. It's like only autistic people go around saying their IQ number because you're supposed to pretend you're stupid or as stupid as the next guy. It's part of our culture. Maybe of more cultures. I don't know. For sure, our culture is very much like this. But the Belzerov is saying the opposite, that, and there has a point. Like you're saying, like. I think there's a lot of Torahs about this, you know, the cult of smart, the guy wrote a book.
Yeah, it's
anyways, he wrote that? No, and someone else wrote a different book about all these like anti-meritocracy people who claim that meritocracy makes everyone worse because then everyone thinks that they deserve everything they have and there's no recognition of this, like...
He's also talking about sort of that's just like...
Your gifts and things.
That it's not, the people get like frustrated when it doesn't pan out because it's just not true. It's just like, it doesn't match reality.
Yeah. So anyways, I don't know, I'm just... The point is, this was just an illustration for the difference between inborn things and bought things, right? So he said that if you have a born good nature, then you could be... By the way, you should be open. Like, people that are confused about their gifts are very in a very messed up place. You shouldn't do. I don't think you have to be that like weirdo that tells everyone, but at least you shouldn't be confused about it. But then you don't really get credit. According to him, you don't get credit. According to Aristotle, you might get credit because Aristotle is much less remembered. Doesn't really believe in effort, but there is still a difference between. Also, Aristotle would in some sense say that nobody is. The Rambam would at least say, and in some sense, I don't know about Aristotle. The Rambam says will say that nobody is really born with good midas. Even that is only a potential of that, and you could be born with a lot of kindness and be a horrible person. And besides, there's another reason, which is that kindness is not good. Only the correct amount of kindness. There's nothing that's good.
Where I think people are saying it's getting. I don't jump the gun here. Okay. People when they say they're born with a lot of kindness, they just mean altederfum. They have the better side of the extreme.
I'm not sure. I think that people that are born kindness just means that they're closer to one extreme, but they actually sometimes, if there's...
I mean, see, they're closer to the extreme that's easier to balance.
That most people are harder to get that.
Too. Right. And you might be on the other side of the extreme. Then yeah,
okay. No, these things are true. Those things are true. I'm just saying that it's probably less... Okay. But the point is, just to make this distinction clear. Like, there's being born with something, and... In some sense, we could talk about something being born with good midas, or at least with the ability to have good midas, ability to actualize those good midas. The Rambam would at least insist on saying it that way. At least in this book, he almost insists on saying it that way. And there are that's not actually having a good midah. Actually having good midah is what these people call, and this translator said, a settled disposition. Not really something like a not just a state. It's like some. Kenyan is actually a nice word that the medieval translators liked for these kind of things. A bought thing. But not a Kenyan. Like the Mishnah, I think the Mishnah already uses it this way, right? Kenyan Torah, like virtue that you bought, something that you have achieved, an achievement that becomes part of you, right? It's not something you bought and put on your shelf, something you bought and put in your soul. We didn't put and became. Right, this language. Okay, and those are also going. They're going to be conforming to the correct activities, right? The correct activities are the equal ones, the mean ones. Therefore, the correct virtues or the correct kenyanim are the ones which are intermediate between two bad states or bad predispositions. One of them, which is too much or missing, or in one of them, which is lacking, because these are the dispositions that. He says Yeschaev, the cause, right? That's really a good word, Yeschaev. Many times when you read it in old books, you should translate it as cause. Sometimes determinately cause, but I don't think it's here, it's determinate, so it's not really. They cause these activities. Okay, so that's all we did. Now, that's all the Rambam gives us. I mean, it doesn't only give us this. Okay, that's basically all the Rambam gives us as far as the definition of the famous middle way. Of course, in Mishneh Torah, he gives some more words for this, maybe. Or I don't know if he gives more words for it.
He doesn't talk about it a lot in Mishneh
Torah. Wait, he gives it in a different way. He says that's a mitzvah. Okay. But what he gives... The only thing he's marich... Okay, so he's not... What he's for sure not marich is to explain what this even means. The only thing he does, both here and in Mishneh Torah, I think a little bit more, I think, is give examples. He does give a bunch of examples. We'll get to those examples. It's another month of learning, at least, to get through the examples. And that's all. And then he talks about how to get the good midas. And then he talks about a bunch of other things. So what we need to do, and here's me getting back to my shtickle plan, and you could help me make my plan better, is that we need to, the first thing we need to do, today and next week, and the week after maybe, is figure out what anyways this thing, of what this middle thing is even supposed to mean. What is it doing for us? What does it help us? How would it be different than saying the good mid are the good ones?
Can I ask you also why? Why is this?
Tell me all the questions. Why?
Why is this the case?
Who says it's true?
Who says it's
case? Maybe it's not true.
Yeah, you're just saying, you're just positing it. Like, what would be the proof to such
thing? The proof for, well, the two questions, right? One would be, what would be the proof for any virtue being the virtue?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe being, like maybe, because you remember, maybe, I'm writing it down so you understand. Oh, I forgot, I don't have my blackboard. In other words, but just to be clear, we're not going to answer that question.
We're not?
Just to preempt the problem. There isn't, not in the, in Aristotle, there is very explicitly isn't even a search for the answer of who told us which are the virtues. There is a lot of search for what are the virtues that we already believe in. But there's zero. It explicitly talks about why he's not going to do it. And we must have discussed this already. But there's explicitly not whoever told me that being kind is good. Remember, for example, just to be clear, we have to make this agdoma also one of my agdomas. And
the question is, remember, if kindness is good or if this measure of kindness is good?
No, he wants both of these questions. He wants to know both. And the answer is something, not the answer. You have to remember something very, very important for everything, which is that philosophy is not about proving things. philosophy is about understanding things. Very big difference. Some modern people and ancient people think that philosophy is about proving things. But it's firstly about understanding things. Now, of course, proof is a very determinate or very defined kind of understanding.
Right.
But it's not primarily about proving things. It's primarily about knowing, or knowing is, since nobody knows what knowing means nowadays, we say understanding. About understanding things. Now, what this means is, or another thing that connects to this is, that thought or philosophy, which is the attempt at or the effort towards understanding, must start somewhere. And it always starts from what you thought until then. It does not start, as Descartes thought, also Descartes does this, just in a very weird way. It doesn't start, like people think Descartes said, by starting from some kind of zero and starting to prove things. Even Descartes doesn't end up actually doing that. It just has a rhetoric that seems to make people think that. That's not how it works. What it does, because why? Because it seems like, well, I don't even know how, if it would just be like stuttering. It wouldn't be anything. What it does, at least what it, the first thing we should expect from it, which is a lot if we get to it, and the original claim of philosophy, which is the original claim of Socrates, is that this will also lead you to abandon all falsehood and discover all truth. In other words, it's enough for the more extreme versions that you were probably thinking of. But first we should say it's enough, and then we'll say that we can get even more. It's enough to understand the things that you already know, or to abandon the parts of them that are wrong, which means that you don't really understand them, and to clarify the parts that you do understand and make them more serious. Does that make sense? Which is another way of saying that we all grow up or receive from somewhere, not from truth, not from philosophy, not from proof, but from opinion, right? From common opinion or from smart authority or from tradition, which is a kind of authority or a kind of common opinion. I don't know which one. We all receive all these notions. We don't live in a blank slate where none of them, and we don't. Maybe we shouldn't. I don't know. We don't. And we all have a bunch of notions, a bunch of thoughts about everything, especially about the things we don't know. In other words, if you're going to go study, and Socrates makes this point in what was the dialogue? Anyways, many in more than once. If we going to, I'm going to ask you some technical question, like how to fix the back seat of my car. You're going to tell me I have no idea. Ask the mechanic, he might know. and the mechanic doesn't know, he's going to look in the correct page on Google where it says, and he'll know the answer. Those are not the kind of subjects that wisdom is about, or knowledge, the kind of knowledge we're talking about, right? Because those are the ones where you know that you don't know, and you might know that someone else knows, and just ask them. Fine. So everything is fine. That's not a good model for people think that this is the model on which knowledge works, but it's not. The problem, the difference, the things like what is a good life, or how, what is a good, what is a virtue, I think that we already pretend to know. Not pretend, we already live as if we know. No human being lives without thinking that he knows what virtues are. If he tells you he doesn't know, that's just a way of getting away from the question, which is a lot of modern, like, I don't know, nihilism kind of thing. It's just like, I don't want to be challenged by you, so I'm going to pretend I don't know. Or it's just that he has very, very bad virtues, doesn't want it to know. I'm not sure. I wanted to say something like, it's because the thing that they think is virtue is something very on a lower level, like on a more abstract level. It's like something like, right? Because anyone that tells you, for example, I'm just going to throw this out, anyone that tells you, I don't know what good is. Everyone should do whatever they want. Okay, so then you have a lower level or higher level concept of the good, which is doing what you want. That's not an automatic thing. We already had this whole long tradition once. That's not just like the default. There's no default. That's just a theory of the good. And now I can start asking you about it and see if it's coherent. But the reason why you tell me I don't know is just I shouldn't ask you, so you shouldn't be able to get to the truth. But if you allow yourself to be asked, then you might. But back to the main point. The main point is that philosophy, at least the way it was practiced almost all the time, is not about proving things from some kind of view from nowhere, but about clarifying the things we already think we know. That's why it's always about subjects that people already have opinions about. That's why most people think that philosophy is useless, because they say, I already think something about this. And then some philosophers think that you can't make progress either, because either you think it or you don't think it, and there's no proofs, no definite proofs. Nobody gets converted almost ever from one ethical theory to another from like reading an article that has a proof or something. Never happens, or doesn't happen in that way at least. Just like people don't get converted to a different religion for that kind of reason almost ever. That's a few weirdos that claim that that's what happened, but they're just not self-conscious. So this is why that's not the kind of thing that we're looking to do. What we're looking to do is to clarify the thoughts we already have. Which is why sometimes when we read some ancient text book, or if someone reads like a book from a different religion, it was like this, like, what does the emulation of Christ mean? And I'm like, who cares? I don't know. It doesn't mean anything. It's nonsense. You shouldn't do it. Okay, then you're not going to get anywhere. This person might actually get somewhere from that. They might actually get something actually true. Something even beyond the sort of concept or the sort of particular language of emulation of Christ, and figure out that, wait, it's because we believe that Christ is some kind of ideal paradigm for a human being. Turns out that it means that the emulation of Christ means being a good person, or means emulating the perfect human who turns out to be divine. Who cares about that? Right? If you did that process of philosophy, of dialectic, he got to somewhere. But if you don't have any, if you don't identify in yourself any, like, I don't think that emulating Christ is good. Christ was a bad guy. You shouldn't, or, okay, you could also, I don't, like, never heard of it, but my mother didn't tell me to do that. So then, I can't have that philosophical conversation with you. All philosophical conversations have to start with something that you already believe or think you know. And that's why, in the same way, actually, not in the same, never really happens, because if you read well enough, you'll realize that we have almost all the virtues that Aristotle, for example, asked, besides for a few of them. For example, there were Jews and Christians that read the ethics and say that this thing that he seems to think is good is actually bad. famously, Meglepsuchia, having been great souls, which people think is just Gava. And Gava, according to the Bible, is bad. I'm not sure if it's even correct, but that's a problem that people have. But in any case, this is why we don't get ever a theory of who says that this is good. And there's deeper reasons and bigger problems with even trying to do that. But we don't. This is not what Aristotle doesn't do that, and therefore I can't do it because it's not clear. There's a whole. Some people claim he does do that because there's. You remember this, Lucius, already. because of the end of the human being, but it doesn't actually do it for any specific virtues. Never says, and this is why Socrates might, Plato might try to do it, but Aristotle never says, and this is why it's good to be kind, or it's good to be a good friend, because such and such. What he does is, and this is the progress that he makes, is he says, we all think that it's good to be a good friend, but we don't know what that means. And because our concepts of it are confused, we seem to think, something I met this morning, we seem to think that we have this basic contradiction if a good friend is someone supposed to make the friend better or worse. Did you notice? Should I do this with you? I want to tell this to you. What's a friend?
I was actually wondering this question because I was reading the Ramish Kanela Hopper and I was stumped. I had literally asked someone today, I'm like, man, I don't know what he means. I don't think modern people know what he means.
Okay, you're getting a bigger problem. I want to show you something very specific. That we all believe that it's good to be a good friend to your friends, or to have friends even, that's said before. But of course, it's true that we mostly don't know how to have friends. Maybe because we don't hang out enough, or we don't hang out in the correct place, or we spend too much time when we're already hanging out, reading a siddur, I don't know, something. Now, there's I could tell you something very simple that we were very confused about. Or, seems to me, do you agree with the statement that a friend is someone that wants good for his friend? Sounds like everyone agrees with that, right? Okay, so therefore, if your friend is making a mistake, what you should do is call him out.
This is the type of thing he said, yeah.
Obviously, I want you to, I have a friend, he's doing a business, he's trying to open a business, he thinks it's nonsense, I'm giving an example, it's nonsense, not going to work, and all of his friends are like, yeah, you're going to do it, because are they friends or enemies? What's going on? It seems like friends, usually when someone has this crazy idea, his friends are the ones telling him to do it, and his enemies are telling him not to do it. It should be the opposite, right? If, assuming, maybe he's wrong, I'm not saying, but nobody, we don't always know, but assuming that all of his friends, that they're right, that it's not a good idea. So why? We're very confused, right? So maybe a friend is a flatterer?
Seems like...
That's not someone that wants his good. That's sounds more like an enemy than a friend. Or maybe a selfish someone that just wants to feel good, wants something for himself.
Source of entertainment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's something very weird. Aristotle gave this, I was reading this, the summary of Aristotle, and he said, a friend is the intermediate between a flatterer and a bad, just a chapignac. Okay, now you taught me something. Now, of course, they didn't solve the problem. But it did tell me that obviously both, you can understand the other option too, right? Is a friend someone that makes his friend feel bad all the time? Probably not either. Is a friend that always looks how to find how his friend's ideas are wrong? Also sounds wrong, right? And I think there's a solution to this. There is a solution. There's a solution that actually solves it, and we could call this solution the intermediate. That is the correct way of being a good friend. There must be a solution. No, those are just sure this. There's actually a formula. I have to think about what is. I think there might be a formula for this. I think the people that are really good at certain things know that, maybe intuitively or even explicitly. But there is a way of a friend that is someone that I'll give you a formula that I was thinking of. Is a friend someone that knocks down all of his friends' opinions or plans? No. Is a friend someone that tells his friend that all of his opinions are great and he's gonna go straight to heaven? Of course not. That's what an enemy is. So a friend is someone in between these two things. Okay, but that doesn't do anything. So a friend is someone
who shouldn't just stay perfectly rigidly addressing it as it is,
right, so I'll tell you, a friend is someone
who judges the opinions of his friends favorably, right?
Yes, but favorably means falsely, so
you gotta assume. No, no.
Not falsely, right? So a friend is someone who makes his friends' ideas better.
Or attributes as much truth to them as possible.
The attributing is even less important now because I'm trying to make him to help him, right? In other words, the enemy is the guy who come with my business idea and it's bad, or at least in the way he's doing it, it's bad. And he says, do it. You know that you have to believe in yourself. And says no, and so on. And the guy is doing it and he's going to fail. Okay, that's a bad friend, or something that people call a friend, but it's not really a friend. And also another bad friend, or another kind of enemy, which is the other extreme, is someone who just says, yeah, it's a bad idea. There's this problem with it, that problem with it, that problem with it. That's also bad. It's also wrong, by the way, because usually ideas are not 100% bad, right? Usually the guy is just raw. He doesn't know how to, doesn't have the right connections, doesn't know how to do it correctly, right? So a friend is not the guy that says, yeah, this is a stupid idea. Why did you even dream of it? What's wrong with you? A friend is the guy that says, sounds like there's something there. How could we actually make it work correctly, given that you're going to have to solve this issue, you're going to have to think of that, and so on. I have it all the time, and I have discussions with people and learning and stuff and whatever. And I have friends and enemies. Or actually, I have a lot of friends, and some of them don't know how to be friends. And some of that, like, there's people that just everything, okay, everything is against, no problem. There's people that just have an agenda, no problem. Then there's people that are, like, a friend is someone who has good questions, but the correct ones. The ones that are helping my, like, sometimes he says, I never thought of that. I think it's crazy, but let's see if we can make it a little less crazy. Okay, now you're helping me. Now tomorrow I'll say the sheet with your modifications, right? So it's true that his friend is someone who's looking for the good, but not looking for the good in like a Breslev way. Looking for to make, that's why a friend is someone who tries to make your ideas good. Not someone who says your ideas are good, nor someone who says your ideas are bad. It's someone that tries to make your ideas good. Now sometimes they're just bad, and maybe then we'll just have to say it, they're bad. But hopefully we're talking about relatively normal people whose ideas are never totally, entirely, 100% crazy. There's always something that just have to be fixed. Why am I